The lithium is crystallizing and we're live. Hey folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff podcast. This is your host, Mike Lafferty. And today we have a themed podcast because we're clever like that. And the theme of today's podcast is noir, defined by, I Googled it just now, a genre of crime fiction or fiction characterized by cynicism, fatalism, and moral ambiguity. And with us today, Amit Mosha is a new guest. We've never had him on before, and he has written a well-received game, had a greatly successful Kickstarter called City of Mist, which is a kind of a superhero noir powered by the apocalypse. Amit, glad to have you.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Rounding out the roundtable, we've got Aide Smith from across the pond. Hey, Aide.
Hello.
Jim Seals from California. Hey, Jim.
Hello.
And Christopher McLaughlin. On the East Coast. How you doing, Chris?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
All right. Oh, hey, Chris. We mentioned this before the podcast. I should mention it again now so the listeners hear it. Wanted to congratulate Green Ronin, who you and Aide often work for, your guys' Kickstarter for the Sentinels of Earth Prime card game funded in like 9 hours yesterday. So congrats on that.
No, thank you very much. It's hard to keep my two patrons down when they come together.
And yeah, it looks like they've already smashed through two stretch goals. So hey, yeah, good luck with the next 28 days on that.
Thank you.
So hey, we're talking noir, and I just gave that cheesy definition, and we were talking, you know, some definitions of, you know, what are good examples of, you know, of the genre, you know, in books, movies, comics. I know one thing Chris mentioned before the podcast was that Orson Welles movie, Touch of Evil. Chris, why do you think that? Could you kind of, you know, give us a 6,000-foot view why you think that's a good example of the genre?
Well, I consider it to be the last great noir because it has that the key elements of it. It's a very, very, very cynical film because it's about a once great man who you sympathize with, but yet he's doing some absolutely deplorable things, and that's kind of one of the key elements of the genre is that you have to be in that gray area between sympathizing with the character and just absolutely hating the things they're doing. Shot with the great contrast between light and shadow. It shows that the two great cinematic influences of Italian neorealism and German expressionism, you know, the fact that those were able to ever coexist in the same genre, much less in the same film, is pretty amazing. It's some of the great cinematic alchemy that keeps me coming back more and more to this genre. And the fact that, you know, it has a dramatically satisfying ending, but typically you're not going to see an ending that has you cheering. You know, Baloo the bear is not going to suddenly open his eyes at the end, you know. You know, all the things that Disney movies taught me as a kid, that, you know, the main characters never really die. It's like film noir is the complete antithesis to that. You know,
it's never just a flesh woman in film noir.
Well, you do occasionally find one where the studio insists on like a tacked on happy ending, but the directors shoot it in such a fashion where you can tell it's absolutely tacked on. I mean, it's everything except the director putting a middle finger up in front of the lens. You know, I'm thinking of like the ending to films like On Dangerous Ground, for instance, you know, where you totally tacked on.
Well, hey, that's kind of a classic example. I mean, Orson Welles, obviously, kind of, you know, one of the archetypes of film noir. Amit, before the podcast, you had mentioned a couple of good examples of maybe modern day examples of the genre, and you were going towards some of the Marvel television, like Jessica Jones and Daredevil. Could you kind of dig into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think they kind of brought it, you know, made it a little bit more modern in these shows. You know, film noir always evokes these 20s, 30s scenes, and then you have the neo-noir starting in the 80s. And I think Marvel did a good job bringing the genre to modern day, especially with Jessica Jones. That's a real kind of, she's a kind of an anti-hero to start with. And yeah, sure, it does go a little bit Baloo, you know, and good characters, or, you know, the characters kind of surviving or not surviving at certain points. But Yeah, I think they did a good job there. I think the feel is right. You know, it's dark. There's definitely this whole gray morality. Who's doing the right deed here? We're not sure. You save someone and then they, you know, basically it bites you in the ass. So I think they did a very good job there.
Yeah, it's the end of episode one or episode two where she's found the girl Kilgrave got. She's reunited her, you know, with her parents. They're getting to the elevator to go back to Nebraska. And just as the elevator door closes, you see the girl pull out the gun.
Yeah, that's pretty dramatic there. And I think also in other shows, even in Daredevil, I mean, there is this whole investigation. They're trying to find, you know, the dirt. Well, not the dirt, but they're trying to find the facts that are constantly being hidden. So these themes of corruption and, you know, with detective work, very much, you know, beating the pavement and searching for those clues, I think are very, very much, you know, they touch on the noir style.
Yeah, I would say you've got a strong streak of fatalism in Daredevil too, just because nothing ever seems to go right for him. I mean, you can talk about the comics even more so, but, you know, even in his the TV series, you know, he almost gets together with the girl and then everything goes to shit. His little girlfriend comes back and, well, she's a crazy assassin, so that's not going to work out. And then, you know.
Yeah, that's just the Daredevil luck.
Yeah, yeah.
But I agree. That's kind of, yeah, I think that's a very fatalism is, or at least this, as you said at the beginning, this cynicism, this inherent cynicism is very much an aspect of, or a theme in noir.
Now, beforehand, we'd been talking a little bit about, you had also mentioned a good example of this being the Fables video game, which I have heard good things about, but I've never touched. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's one of the video games I enjoyed the most in recent years. I mean, it's just, it's awesome. It's you play Bigby, the big bad wolf. So Fables, you know, these are their legends in New York, and it's just beautiful. It's actually been a big inspiration for City of Mist, because City of Mist is also kind of about legends. But I think the thing I like the most about the game is the conversation, the way the conversation built. You have like a timer, and it runs the time runs out on you to choose what you're going to say. And there's always the option of silence. And I thought that was beautiful, because that's just as powerful as, and it's a valid option. It has its consequences and different consequences in different conversations. So it's a very conversational game, you know. And they just got all the characters right, you know, the kind of the prostitute that was forced into it, and the petty criminal, and just, it's beautiful. So if you want to check out some, you know, unusual supers or supernatural noir, you should really play that game.
Cool. Yeah, something I've been meaning to check out, but had a kid recently, well, 4 years ago, and just really put a cramp on my video game time, unfortunately, so... Maybe once he goes away to summer camp in a few years, we'll have some time to catch up.
That's going to be a back catalog.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it's a mobile game, so I think it's something you could...
That makes a lot easier, because I ride the bus every day. So I can't always play Sentinels of the Multiverse. Oh, hey, Chris, if you want to play Sentinels of the Multiverse sometime, if you've got an iPhone, there's an app, and you can do multiplayer. So let me know.
Well, I appreciate that, but my phone is barely, it's one notch above two cans and string.
I hear you. Yeah, I did that way for a long time. Makes life easier with a simple phone.
True story. My wife added me to her cell phone account. They said, pick out the phone you want. I grabbed it, and they cut her bill by $15 a month when they saw my phone.
What the hell?
Yes. I made a cell phone company feel bad for us.
That's hard to do. That's like making Ebenezer Scrooge cry. I mean, that's a feat.
Yep.
All right. Hey, beforehand, we were talking about comic books that, you know, traffic in noir, if you will. And I mentioned Brubaker, because I can't have a podcast without talking about Brubaker for some reason. Mm-hmm. But Jim brought up a comic I had forgotten about that I'd actually read, that was Scenes of the Crime by Brubaker. It was a four-issue limited series by DC back in 99. Could you talk about that a little bit, Jim?
Well, I remember it predominantly for the Michael Wonk, who is Brubaker's regular artist they use when he's not using Sean Phillips. Wonk is constantly there. He was on Gotham Central, and they were writing that crime comic, and it was just sort of a Ghoul shows up dead in a sort of apartment kind of setting, and the artwork is always evocative, and I think visuals are key to telling a noir story, because really at the heart of noir fiction is the protagonist, who is always a cynic. And I'm sort of reminded of this George Carlin quote, inside every cynical person, there was a disappointed idealist. So you need that sort of dichotomy of there was a time when that person was not cynical, and then there was the time that this story is starting and this story is going. And it's that person wrestling with the moral quandaries of whatever the problem is. You know, it can be anything, whatever the MacGuffin is that he needs to resolve. But for him, it's trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to go about this? And is it going to bring about the results I want? And invariably, it's always no. And sometimes he may even accomplish his goal, but he'll lose sort of the moral high ground to do it. I believe that was in that book. But Vortigo has also published a whole series of crime graphic novels called Vortigo Crime. They came in like little hardbacks, the size of those Archie hardbacks, paperbacks that you see in grocery stores. I think Brian Azzarello did one that was pretty good. Was it Filthy Rich, I believe it was called? And that I think that was the first novel in the line. And that opens up in the very sort of skeezy setting of finding a prostitute in the back of a taxi and sort of rolling from there.
Cool. Yeah, I like Seeds of the Crime because it sort of seems like Brubaker was kind of sort of finding his footsteps, finding his feet in the genre. It was nice to see sort of the inception of all that. Kind of reminds me, and boy, this is sort of a horrible tangent, so let's make it quick. there was a Netflix movie came out on Valentine's Day this year called Girlfriend's Day. Had Bob Odenkirk, who's Saul Goodman from Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. And it's the strangest little movie. I don't know if it would be made anywhere but on Netflix. It's basically a film noir set in the greeting card industry in LA. You know, instead of a PI, he's down on his luck greeting card writer who's struggling against this great criminal conspiracy in the greeting card industry. And it's not hilarious. It's kind of mildly amusing the whole way through. I couldn't help but watch it because I was so happy that a movie that weird existed. Aide, you've been awfully quiet this whole time. Anything about the genre you'd like to point out or particular examples you want to talk about?
First of all, let me just say, City Mist looks absolutely gorgeous. I just want to say that now because I haven't had a chance to play it. I've only had a chance to read through it, but it is absolutely stunning book. Absolutely love it.
Thank you.
I was just thinking when you were talking about noir, does the Fargo TV series, does that fit into noir? Is that kind of thing, or is that something like another genre? Cause it just seems to be the main character just makes his life worse and worse for himself, no matter how hard he tries to get himself out of crappier situations.
Well, I would argue that it was, but we have an actual English professor on the call, so maybe we should
Chris Wayne. Okay, go, Professor, go!
I lost you for a second. What property are we discussing? I got the last part of your question, but what property are we talking about?
The Fargo TV series.
I actually haven't seen the TV series because I was so honestly put off by the idea of somebody trying to make a Coen series. I skipped it.
No.
I understand it's terrific, but
you should
just
really watch it. It is really, 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 really good. And this is someone who loves the Fargo movie. Absolutely loves the Fargo movie.
Well, it's the same question about the movie then, because the TV show is trying its earnest best to replicate that kind of a vibe. Would you say the Fargo is a noir, or maybe just goes with the crime fiction?
Okay, category? All right. Now, you have to understand, I am a total purist. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's possible to make a true noir after 1958. And yeah, with one very, 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 very minor exception, I don't think it's possible to make a noir in color. But I
yeah,
think,
see, that's.
But I think
that's what jumps to my mind. Black and white. Straight
but
away,
but right? I think you could definitely cite it as an example of neo noir. The one thing that makes me hesitate to put it fully as a neo noir is that since we never really find out what makes Jerry Lundegaard, you know, engage in that elaborate financial cover up scheme, you maybe don't sympathize with him as much as you should. I think the Coens do a masterful job of getting you to sympathize with this guy just by showing how crappy his life is. Like that wonderful wordless scene where his father-in-law has turned him down for the money he was counting on, and he has to go back out and, you know, try to scrape, you know, 6 inches of Minnesota ice off his car, which, you know, to this Southerner apparently appeared in like 10 minutes. You know,
it does that sometimes, you know.
I'm totally in awe of that. I totally, utterly in awe of that. But yeah, I'd feel comfortable putting it there, even if maybe just for me you don't quite sympathize enough with Jerry Lundegaard for it to count 100%.
What about Breaking Bad as a neo noir then?
That's another good one. I guess it really depends on the degree by which you still feel some sympathy for Walter White by the time you hit that final episode and he's done all those incredibly terrible things and you kind of barely remember that this all used to be about the fact he had cancer and stuff.
Well, I mean, it started off as almost a comedy. In fact, it was kind of advertised as comedy the first couple seasons, and, you know, poor sad sack Walt, his wife doesn't really care for him. Yeah. He's kind of a joke at school, and then, oh, he's cooking meth and killing dudes. And,
yeah,
you know, it took a real dark left turn at some point.
But do you feel that?
Yeah, I tell you the thing that makes me think Breaking Bad might fit in there is the some of the most telling noir moments are when a character or a protagonist is defeated by just incredibly random chance. I mean, fate is totally out to get you in the genre, and just some of the incredible things that have to happen to take Walter down at the end, I think certainly puts it in noir territory.
Do you feel that the noir has to include mystery in it? Even if it's not supernatural mystery, just some kind of a question, like an investigation, or it's not. What do you think?
I think you have to have a crime of some kind. You know, even, you know, I was watching, where is it on my shelf here? Make sure I get the title right. I was watching Clash by Night with Barbara Stanwyck, Paul Douglas, Robert Ryan, and a very, very early part for Marilyn Monroe. And I think even the guy doing the audio commentary questions about, is this totally noir? Because the only real crime that you get in there for most of the film is adultery. And that's kind of dodgy as far as your typical noir crime. But the whole film kind of hangs on more of a question of motivation more than mystery. So I think maybe you don't always have to have a mystery in terms of who did it or how they did it, but I think you can hang noir on the mystery of, you know, why is a character doing this, what will a character do.
See, for me, I always get noir and pulp kind of lumped together. So when we last had the discussion about noir, I watched A Touch of Evil because you suggested to watch it. And I've just looked I've just Wikipedia'd another one. There's a film called Brick that came out in 2005, which is actually says neo-noir, because I was going to mention that is a very good film. And it actually says on Wikipedia, so it must be true, it's a neo-noir. So I am correct in actually, so I'm getting there. I'm getting my genres, I'm getting down there. But yeah, my noir radar just slowly drifts into pulp and then back again, so...
Yeah, I saw Brick after I saw his follow-up film, Loophole. It's in color, and that's sort of that was my criticism. you have this very noir plot, like, and all the characters, even though it was in a high school setting, they were all following the tropes of the genre. There was the investigative guy who didn't want to be involved. He kept getting dragged and folded and folded and folded. It was fatalistic. It did not resolve in a pleasant, you know, Disney fashion. But ultimately, it's in color. And the problem is the reason why noir works, visually speaking, in black and white is because the only thing black and white with it is the image. Everything else in the content is gray. It's all sort of shades of gray in terms of, like, what's your lesser of 3, 4, 6 evils? And then having characters go about struggling with those more consequences.
So do we think Sin City works as an example of noir, or is it borderline?
Well, it's black and white.
Well, no, it isn't. It has one more color, so it's not noir anymore.
Oh, that's right? True. Yeah, it has got a bit of red in it as well. That's very true. Yeah.
That sequel was called That Yellow Bastard.
It's gone. That's it.
Would anyone argue or debate that maybe Miller crosses the line into parody at some point in Sin City?
What, are we talking about the movie? We're talking about the actual comic books.
I'll take either one.
Because the comic books, I really did enjoy the comic books. I thought they were really, really good. And I remember when they first came out and it was something completely different because it was that really heavy, blocky, black and white style that was not something I'd seen anywhere else. And I didn't get the issues as they came out. I kind of picked up trades as they come through. And yeah, I think obviously he's playing on tropes rather than, and kind of like almost stereotypes of characters in there. If it's like, hey, we've got to have this guy, we've got to have that guy. But then you start putting ninjas and stuff in it. Then you start going off the rails slightly from the original noir lots. And you say, yeah. But the movie itself, it's all right. It's okay. It looked like the books. And if that was what he was aiming for, he did a good job there. But apart from that, it's all right.
Well, fair enough. Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. I remember reading one review of Sin City the movie, where the guy was like, you know, I'd like to shoot Frank Miller just once in the gut with the .22, so he knows what it feels like. You don't just shrug that off and keep on going.
Because the odd thing, the spirit looks exactly the same as well.
Yeah, yeah.
The spirit's virtually exactly the same, kind of that kind of heavy, saturated color, black and white, and all this kind of stuff. And again, that's a noir character. Unless would that be a pulpy character or noir? I don't know, but I would say the spirit is kind of in that kind of ballpark. So maybe black and white is the key.
And how much happiness you have in it, you know? But you know, yeah. We even with my creative partners in the Eminem Noir book, we went through a whole thing. What's the difference between pulp and noir? And I just said, okay, Doc Savage is pulp. Okay. A guy, Humphrey Bogart and Maltese Falcon, that's noir. You know, Humphrey Bogart doesn't have, like, you know, five of the most talented people ready to help him. He's not rich. He doesn't have, you know, a fleet of jetliners and limos. And, you know, he technically wins at the end, but he's not happy about it.
And Bogart, sort of the quintessential, like, how I came to noir was I saw Casablanca and I saw this actor and he just blew my mind. Yeah. And then I went through his back catalog of material.
Oh yeah.
At that time, I think Criterion was producing some of, like, I think The Big Sleep had just come out or something on DVD. And I just kept going further and further down the rabbit hole and being intoxicated. The thing about Bogart that's so great is he's not good looking. He's not the smallest man in the room. He's not the strongest man in the room. He's like, he doesn't even have the quick draw that you get in the Westerns. What he's got is stick-to-itiveness. He's gonna stay with this like a flea on a dog. Barely the dog will bite him.
Well, yeah, he's pretty superheroic as Sam Spade, but you're right. A lot of his later characters get by just on scrappiness.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, since you have raised the specter, or maybe that's a bad way to put it, you raise the subject of noir-related superheroes and noir-related superhero games with Mutants and Masterminds Noir. Can you give us a quick elevator pitch for maybe listeners who aren't familiar with that?
Well, back in first edition M&M, back when everything with M&M on it was completely and utterly selling out, we decided to try and kind of show off what we could do with the system and kind of try to give people something they had never seen before. And that was my noir book, a way to combine. It was a book that was about how to combine noir and superheroes. And I spent the next 8 months to a year being roasted alive online. I got all my writer scars, my like outer protective writer layer from just seeing post after post on RPGNet that would like veer off topic just to talk about how crappy my book was.
Well, you know what? I happen to have read the book. I own a copy and I actually liked it. But what kind of criticisms were you saying were up for it?
Well, thank you. I just think people were kind of expecting us if I remember correctly, I think noir may have been like the fourth or fifth M&M book that ever came out. And I think people were kind of expecting us to do like a gadget book or something more obvious. And it was just so really different than I think any other superhero RPG had tried. I think a lot of people bought it because of the M&M label, and they just kind of went, what the hell is this? What is this arty role-playing crap in this? I want more options for flinging buses at people. I don't want to read this crap about where, you know, my hero wins at the end and then gets really depressed. So it's sort of my misunderstood child that I keep chained up in the basement, throw some scraps down there every now and again. There's like a half dozen people who really, really, really love it. And from what I can tell from RPGNet, about 300 people that would literally just set me on fire for having wasted their $20 on that book.
See, I love it. I went out my way to eBay it to make sure I got one, because I knew you wrote it, and I went out to make sure I paid a little bit extra for it, but that way got it eventually.
Well,
I just love 1940s stuff. That kind of era is just fantastic. It's
very kind. It's kind of emblematic of like nothing that anybody would ever do again these days. I do lament that part of it. I do kind of miss that period 10 years ago where it was like, I've got an idea, and there was still enough of that initial D20 wave left where, you know, people would take a chance and put something out like that in book form.
But have we now surpassed that? Because now we are seeing a lot more games that are set in kind of the 40s eras and noir stuff and pulpy kind of thing. So maybe the Mutants and Masterminds crowd weren't the people that were ready for it, but maybe the role-playing people in general, if you can say, hey, this is a noir book, but it uses the Mutants and Masterminds system, maybe they may go for it.
I'll let more talented people than I take a crack at noir superheroes. Now I lost a couple of fingers in my try, and I'm in absolutely no hurry to go back.
I was about to introduce you anyway, so please go ahead and admit.
Well, I was just going to say I agree with Aide, and I think, Chris, you were maybe a little bit ahead of your time, or maybe hitting the wrong audience there, because I think that's exactly what people are looking for, or some audiences are definitely looking for that more role-playing, touch to a setting than just flinging buses and shooting ray guns. I think that's very much becoming a thing now, narrative gaming and more role-playing, more mechanic-driven role-playing. So not just like, give me a set of rules and I'll do the role-playing, side by side with that. But I want the game to encourage me to role-play or create all kinds of situations for me to role-play around. So I think that was just... come on over to PBTA Games. I think you'll be great.
Thank you for the kind words, sir. And I hope a lot of people will check out your game, because I'm really excited just from the sound of it, just from what I'm seeing at your website.
I hate to bring out dollar figures, but Mitt raised over $100,000 for City of Mists last year. So
and Noir sold out for what it's worth, So yeah, apparently there is a market for this.
Yeah,
I think there is definitely. And yeah, we were very lucky with the Kickstarter. It was just amazing. The people really responded to it, and that's it. We're making the game.
Apocalypse World is a very good system, though. It's very versatile that you can use it for different genres and stuff. So as long as you can kind of get your head around of modifying it, the core of it is really, really nice to build stuff upon. So that's cool. That's you know, like I say, it's kind of like the old D20 days where it's like, hey, Dungeons & Dragons is the core system. Let's all do stuff for that. It's just like, hey, Apocalypse World. Now let's do oh no, Fate as well. Oh yeah, yeah. So it's fantastic. Yeah, yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, we just had Brendan Conway on to talk about Masks, which is another PBTA game, I believe.
Yeah, so, you know, the superheroes in PBTA, that's kind of tricky in a way. And there was a very, very interesting and good attempt made with Worlds in Peril, which was the first superhero PBTA game I know of. It was very good. What was good about it, what I liked about it, is that it didn't strictly define your powers. You would just write something like what's possible for you to do, what's totally impossible, what's borderline, and then you kind of work around that. So I thought that was pretty creative. Masks goes a totally different way. I think Masks is ingenious for its social aspects, like your attributes are actually your social positions as the savior, as the outcast, as the beast. I don't exactly remember it. Like superhero, teenage superhero social positions. And other people can change them for you by telling you you're not that or you are that. I think that's just ingenious.
Oh, yeah.
But and correct me here if I'm wrong, because I only saw Masks, like, you know, their quick start rule set. But I saw that there was like the superpowers themselves were based on set moves that you could choose, and yeah, I always find that is that the way.
Each playbook has kind of got a set of moves, but the moves have kind of loosely defined powers. So if you want to play a guy that's like Cyclops, then your whatever move is an optic blast. If you want to play somebody different, like Human Torch, then that same move is now a fire blast or something else. So it's not, they're not totally, there is some leeway there, but the playbooks have their own moves. Yeah.
Right. So I thought that was perfect for that type of game, because I think they really didn't want to take any focus from that amazing social mechanic that I just love that. I was trying to create something totally the opposite directions, something that was completely text-based. Almost completely text-based. I mean, there are no attributes in City of Mist. There's all you have is the tags describing your character, and when you roll any kind of move, you just count the number of tags that are relevant for your action, and you add it to your roll. So it's like people say it's the combination of PBTA and Fate. In actuality, it's the combination of PBTA and another system called Lady Blackbird. I don't know if you guys played it. It's pretty ingenious. Also a tag-based system. So the concept was to allow people to create any kind of power they want without getting into the crunchy, you know, the crunchy descriptive systems like Hero System, Mutants, Masterminds, which are their own fun, but they're not PBTA. So,
fair enough. The Kickstarter was a big success last year. Have you delivered yet, or are you still in the process of delivering?
No, we're still in development. The first book should come out on August, and we started pre-order, which is fantastic. But we're still in development, and it's already in this conversation I'm getting a lot of ideas and directions. So for example, maybe I need to just edit the whole thing and say it's neo-noir, because we definitely are going to have a full color book. So
yeah, you can't, the artwork's too,
sorry,
good
guys, it's neo-noir.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
No, yeah, I could advise releasing a black and white noir book. That's another thing you'll get roasted for. Ask me how I know that.
Well, no, you just make it the collector's edition, right? And you charge extra $20 for it. You're paying more for less.
Yes, there's price, a businessman.
$20. Yeah.
You're a deeply cynical man, Jim Seals.
Yep.
Well, if listeners want to check out City of Mist, if you go to RPG Now or Drive Through, do a search on the phrase City of Mist or Mint Musha, He's got quick start rules, starter set rule book up for free. You've got a playbook, starter set extras, and a couple of, let's see, I see two, are these adventures? City of Mist, first case, V for going, can you tell us about those?
Yeah, there's two cases. The first one, V's for Going Viral, is it's kind of a very simple investigation. It's mostly to try out the game and the mechanics and get into it. The second one, Demons of Cross End, is already a more, it's like a full-blown case. Still not very long, but like with enough materials to keep things interesting for a couple of sessions. And that has more of this gray morality, you know, people doing things because they have to. And then every time I run this case in you know, in conventions and stuff like that, the ending is different and different characters end up making different decisions. I mean, this is kind of the core mechanic of City of Mist, is a mechanic of inner conflict. I mean, I was listening to what Jim said there, that definition of what the character is experiencing, and I was thinking, fantastic. I mean, this is really what I'm getting at with City of Mist. You know, you have your four themes and they're constantly conflicting with each other and forcing you to make hard choices. So that's more present there in the more advanced case. And we unlocked six more cases that we're going to write right after the core book. So there's going to be plenty of content with that.
Okay, cool. And when do you think that'll be going live or be getting published?
We set August 2017 as the goal for that. Right now we're on schedule. I hope it stays this way. There's a lot going on in development, and it's first time. So, but I think we'll be good for August.
Okay, good. Glad to hear that. Could we ever talk you into coming back and running a playtest, or is that really too involved to do over a podcast?
No, I think we could definitely do a playtest. Yeah, I'd be delighted.
How long would that take? A couple hours? One, two, three? How long do you think?
I think a good, you know, fun case with kind of a little bit of drama at the end could probably take 3 hours.
Okay, all right. That might be hard to schedule, but I'll see what we can set up. That sounds like it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'd be totally up for it.
Cool. So if we're talking about superheroes and noir, do we
want to... I'm back.
Oh, hey, how you doing, Chris?
Sorry, I completely lost my internet connection for a sec.
No worries. Well, let me ask you, is Dark Knight Returns more of a pulp or more of a noir? Or some unholy amalgam of the two?
I guess it really depends on... in color, so it would best be neo-noir. I guess it would really, really depend on how much you see either Batman or even to a greater extent Superman being a captive of bad decisions that we at least sympathize with why they made them. You know, to me, the two great weaknesses of Dark Knight Returns is this like really, really silly cartoonish portrayal of Reagan and an equally silly and cartoonish portrayal of Superman. I mean, granted, unless Superman suddenly becomes a right-wing dick, you don't have a story. But it just, to me, that's never really, it's never really rang true. Extent that we're supposed to sympathize with the reasons that Superman became a right-wing dick, I guess it could be. But I've always found Dark Knight to be very overrated. Honestly, of all the supposedly great comic artists, Frank Miller, I will freely admit, is the one that for the most part, I just don't get.
So I thought you were going to say overrated.
Sorry,
I'm always enthusiastic when I hear someone take a critical look at The Dark Knight Returns. As a Batman fan, I've never been over the moon on that. I think probably a better noir story for Batman would maybe be Son of the Demon.
Oh yeah,
that's got a lot of elements. Reagan's in it too. But he's only on one page, and there was a lot of moral ambiguity as to what it is that Batman is coming to terms and teaming up with a terrorist to solve the day, you know, to save the problem. And it doesn't end on a happy note. So
yes.
See, as someone who likes the original Dark Knight Returns and likes that star, Miller's, that's probably one of my favorite Lord Miller artwork. I was going to thought you were going to say the sequels was what the problem was with Dark Knight Returns, because Dark Knight 2 and Dark Knight 3 are definitely not as good in any way or form. Dark Knight 3 seems to just be kind of just limbering along at the moment and kind of like, well, come out when it comes out, and there's a thing going on somewhere. So yeah.
Well, you've kind of lost me just to mention the word sequel in any context. And I think that's a good example of why they're 90% of the time they're just worthless. They just shouldn't attempt a sequel to anything.
Yeah, my wife doesn't go. I have a sequels rule where I won't, except for very specific franchises that kind of have a shroud of nostalgia about them. I just can't do sequels. And
my general sequels rule is about, I give maybe a one sequel and possibly two, but once they're in like number seven, then you know there's something going wrong, and you're just milking the cow. That's all you're doing.
Yeah.
Except for the Fast and the Furious franchise, which just kept getting better with each every one.
I couldn't stand the first one, so I just
after that. My wife watches them, and I sleep through it. Yeah. So.
I was about to say I have a fondness for films that you go in not expecting them to be any good. Like, I've grown up loving like the Universal Mummy series from the 40s, even though you know that they're all going to be fucking terrible after the first one.
You know, the one reduction.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, in fact, I was sharing with a friend of mine who had no familiarity with Universal Horror, and I was telling her that, like, I honestly think, like, the last Lon Chaney Jr. Mummy sequel is, like, 58 minutes long, like, start to finish. And she's like, well, what's the name of that one? The titles all blend together at some point. And I said, you know, they might as well just call it The Mummy pretty much just doesn't give a damn anymore. There you go. That's your title. You know, The Mummy no longer gives a crap. There you go.
He's very tired. He wants to move to Boca. He's got other things on his mind, but he'll threaten you if it, you know, gets the job done. So.
He's probably met Abbott and Costello by then as well, isn't he? So he's, yeah, he's just give up completely.
Oh, God.
One redemption of the Fast and Furious movies is that they will hire really great cinematographers. So you'll have, you know, kind of just dopey movies about guys in fast cars, but they'll just be shot beautifully. So if you have to watch them, let's say if you have a wife who's really into that franchise, that's one thing to look forward to. You don't get that same kind of satisfaction out of, say, the Transformers movies, which,
any satisfaction out of Transformers movies, I'm sorry.
It's a thing. Chris, you
if
had
it's
mentioned...
It's not G1, it's not animated, it's not Transformers.
Well, on the plus side, for old-time Transformers fans, I mean, the horrible Michael Bay movies make billions of dollars, and they prompt Hasbro to keep the toy line and the comic book line alive. So there's a silver lining there. Speaking of silver linings, and that's an awkward segue, Chris, you had mentioned Sandman Mystery Theater as a comic you want to touch on this podcast. Could you dig on that a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I may trigger like everyone at RPGNet to go off and burn all their copies of it, but that was the comic that put the idea to do the noir sourcebook in my film. I had never in my life, well, I'd been out of comics for like 10 years, you know, after, you know, like an education and girls and other things in my life. But Sandman Mystery Theater was the thing that pulled me back into comics, because I had never seen with a protagonist quite that flawed and quite that haunted by his powers. You know, I mean, I know that that's Marvel's stock and trade, but, you know, it just seemed like, you know, Peter Parker whining about his wisdom teeth was no comparison to Wesley Dodds being completely unable to sleep because every time he closed his eyes, he sees another horrific graphic murder. I don't know if anybody's topped that for a more haunted character. And so, yeah, this the idea of still being able to do something that's at least superficially superheroic in the context of such broken and flawed characters, that's what I wanted to take off and run with. And, you know, and I don't like, okay, here you go. Since you're my friend, you get this story for the very, very, very first time. One of the proudest moments of my life was I took one of my author's copies of Noir, and gave it to Matt Wagner himself.
Oh, nice.
And Matt Wagner. and Matt Wagner sit there and flip. I mean, it's not like he sat there and read the whole damn book. I'm not going to make this out to be more than it is, but he at least flipped through it. He looked where I dedicated the book to him, and he said, "This looks really cool, and thank you."
Oh wow, that is
so. If Matt Wagner didn't throw it, you know, Matt Wagner didn't throw it at me like I think half of the internet wanted to at some point. So yeah, there you go. I felt at least that much vindicated. I did okay by my inspiration.
You have just described the most positive Matt Wagner interaction I've ever heard.
He's always been fabulous.
I'm just saying. I usually hear Matt Wagner stories where it's a little more dramatic than that. I'm glad that's really? A great story. Yeah, he's he's often a nice guy, but especially in the afternoon at conventions, I think he gets a little cranky.
I met him in the morning of a convention, and he was nice to me. He drew a little Batman picture in my Batman Noir black and white collection. So I was pretty happy with that. So I cannot say bad things about
Steve, there are two guys who had good Matt Wagner stories. Mike doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. So Matt Wagner's apparently a good guy. So, hey.
Well, I mean, he comes. He's been to pretty much every single Baltimore Comic Con, and I've never missed a one. And, you know, slowly but surely, I'm getting him to sign every single issue of Sandman Mystery Theater. He's never been anything but nice to me. And, in fact, I've seen him be nice to the people that tend to be the most annoying folks of all the comics, the people who are demanding original art and sketches right there on the spot.
Really? Okay, well, maybe I've just talked to people who were jerky to him, and that's why I'm getting that from. So I'm glad to hear I was an error on that. So that's
I mean, I wouldn't walk up to him wearing like a Make America Great Again hat, but you know, I mean, you know, we've all got our limits.
Oh, I don't want to talk about politics, Chris, but yeah, it's a thing, isn't it? So
yep.
I've got a neighbor down the street who I get along with really well. He's a kindly old man. He shovels, you know, he's got a snowplow he brings out when we get like a foot in an hour, you know, which happens in Colorado. But he wears this red Donald Trump hat around. And every once in a while, I'm tempted to go up and talk politics with him. And then I'm like, nah, that's a bad idea. So I just talk about football with him or something else. But yeah. Well, anyway, we've been talking for about an hour, and I know it's about midnight where Amit is. So we should probably start wrapping up. Anything else you want to touch on before we close things down, Amit?
No, I think we really touched on so many different subjects today. I'll just say, if anyone is interested, you can pick up the starter set on our website, like you said, and we have some really good deals right now for pre-order. So if you like the starter set, you can check out the deals we have. And that's it.
Pre-orders. Where do they find a pre-order?
The pre-order is you just go to the cityofmist.co, not .com, .co, and you click get the game, and you have all the pre-order offers.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I hadn't noticed that, so that's good information. Cool. Right there in the front, big purple button, get the game. All righty. Mr. McLaughlin, anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap up?
I just wanted to wish best of luck and Godspeed to the newcomer, and apparently it looks like the best noir superheroes game ever. So Godspeed to you, sir, on your game.
Hey, thanks. That's a lot. Thank you very much.
And if you go to the cityofmist.co website, be aware there is some music on some of the pages. So if you're browsing at work, be careful.
I'm so glad you told me that. I'm due back in class tomorrow. I think you just saved me a lot of embarrassment.
So, Abe, anything else you want to touch on?
That's all good, I think.
All right, cool. Mr. Seals?
No, I'm good.
All right, cool. Well, hey, thanks for everybody for joining us. And check out City of Mist. And if you can find a copy of Noir for First Ed Mutants and Masterminds, I think it's really a great book. And you can get it for like 10 bucks right now on Amazon. So you should check it out. And thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next time on the Banff Podcast.